Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
It's good to be back. We have been apart for too long. Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast. I'm your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker, Trent Horn. And today I'm going to be responding to a short argument against the resurrection of Jesus Christ being put out by counter-apologists. So it's interesting on the internet, some people will derisively refer to me as an apologist. You know, people will sometimes say, oh, here's what Trent Horn says about X. And atheists on the internet, especially quote-unquote new atheists or the internet atheists, will say, oh, I don't need to listen to what an apologist has to say. Now, an apologist is just someone who defends a particular position. Some of these atheists online will take the term apologist and think it only applies to people who are defending Christianity. But I've got a newsflash for you. If you defend any position, including atheism, which is a position, by the way, some atheists will say, well, atheism isn't a belief, it's a lack of belief. But that's too simple. I mean, babies and pickup trucks and raccoons, they all lack a belief in God, but they're not atheists. And if they are atheists, that doesn't say a lot about atheism. Rather, atheism has positive beliefs, either that God does not exist or that the reasons that are put forward to believe in God are insufficient or that the arguments for the existence of God fail. Those are positive claims, and you need to defend those claims if you're going to make them. So atheists who defend those claims, they are apologists. So that's why I like the work of counter-apologists. I think he would probably recognize himself as being an apologist for atheism, but he specifically focuses on countering Christian apologetics. So he's counter-apologist. He has a short argument against the resurrection that I thought would be a great element to treat here on the podcast. But before we get to that, though, I want to give a big shout out to our supporters at TrenthornPodcast.com. You guys make the podcast possible. Just with your monthly support, even at $5 a month, you get access to bonus content. You have exclusive ability to message me, give me ideas for future episodes, to comment on episodes, to submit questions for our open mailbag. And in fact, we're going to do an open mailbag on faith and politics. So faith and politics here as the election season heats up. We're going to be doing that open mailbag episode very soon. People have already submitted questions to it, but if you want to submit questions to a future episode, consider becoming a subscriber. If you subscribe at the gold level or higher, you get premium access to having your questions answered, and you get a mug with my mug on it. You get a mug with the Council of Trent logo. And finally, if you choose to support the Council of Trent podcast and you make an annual gift that Patreon is finally letting people do, if you make an annual gift, you get a 15% discount off of your giving, off of your membership. So that can apply to whether you're making a new gift to support the podcast right now, or if you're currently a monthly supporter at TrenthornPodcast.com, you can upgrade your membership to an annual one and you get that 15% discount. And now without further ado, let me play you part of Counter Apologist's video. So this is the shorter argument. I think he has one that's an hour long. I usually save those for my rebuttal videos over on our YouTube channel. Be sure, if you haven't gone there, by the way, be sure to go and subscribe to the Council of Trent on YouTube. We have multi-hour rebuttal videos there. But I thought it'd be nice for the podcast just to focus on a short argument and then show you how I would rebut this particular argument. So let's jump right in and do that.
The argument for the resurrection comes in many forms, but they all eventually come back to referencing the Bible stories about Jesus being crucified and resurrected. They are all based on testimonial evidence for a miracle occurring in the past, and unfortunately for Christians, testimony cannot be used in an evidential way to justify belief in a miracle claim in the world that we live in.
When people say this, notice that he says Bible stories instead of Bible accounts. It's interesting that when you have atheists criticizing the resurrection, the extreme skepticism that they have towards history in general really starts to show that they'll talk about the Bible as just stories. I mean, they don't do the same thing with the accounts from Josephus or Tacitus or Thucydides or Herodotus, you know, ancient Greek and ancient Roman historians. They just say, oh, well, that's not evidence. That's testimony from a long time ago. Well, that's the only way we could ever know anything about history. If you took some of these atheistic arguments to their logical conclusion, you'd have to be an agnostic about all kinds of historical events. So what the atheist has to do, if he's saying that we can't trust past testimony of events, he has to show, all right, why do we believe history in general? And where is the boundary that says that historical evidence, past testimony, quote-unquote stories, if you will, it can establish events in the past, but it can't establish miraculous events in the past? We should really press our atheist critics to say, all right, why do you draw the line between natural events and supernatural events? Why can historical testimony vouch for one kind of an event, but not for the other?
This will be the first argument that I will be addressing. What if I told you that I woke up in my bed in New Jersey this morning, then had lunch on the moon, but then was home here on Earth for dinner? You probably wouldn't believe me. Now pretend we were in the universe of Star Trek: The Next Generation. My same statement about waking up on Earth, eating lunch on the moon, and then being back on Earth for dinner would be extremely plausible, and you wouldn't bat an eye at that statement if you were living in that universe. The difference is the background knowledge in each case. In Star Trek, there are transporters that could span an incredible distance in a second, not to mention galaxy-class starships that make such a feat possible. In the real world, only a handful of human beings have undergone the training and incredible journey via rocket spacecraft to make it to the moon, a process that takes a lot longer than a day. Now, what if my statement was about me doing something physically impossible that no level of technology can overcome?
Okay, so this is an important point that he's bringing up, and that would be background knowledge. So, for example, if somebody tells you, I own a dog, you don't find that to be a very startling claim because you have background knowledge that dogs exist. You probably owned a dog or know someone who owned a dog. So it's just not that surprising for you for a claim. You compare the claim to your background knowledge of the world. If somebody says, I own a tiger, you might be a bit more suspicious of the claim, but maybe you've seen Tiger King on Netflix or something like that. So you might be a bit more suspicious. You may not accept the claim right away. You compare it to your background knowledge of the ownership of tigers. Now, if somebody said, I own a dragon, you're going to be extremely suspicious because you have a lot of background knowledge that mitigates against the existence of dragons. For example, they're not recognized animals that exist by any zoological society. If there were dragons that existed, we would expect that many, many more people could testify that they do exist. If there are these creatures out there, we would expect more evidence for them. And since we don't, that tilts our background knowledge against dragons existing, which justifies you being very skeptical of the claim from someone who says that they own a dragon. And so it is important for atheists to bring up background knowledge. And what they'll do is they'll import that to discussions about the resurrection. And they'll say, well, look, when people die, they stay dead. That's our background knowledge. And yet you're going to say that Jesus rose from the dead? That completely contradicts the background knowledge that we have. No, because our claim as Christians is not that Jesus rose from the dead naturally, that through some natural means, he came back to life. That would be a claim to be highly suspicious of. Our claim, and counter-apologists will get to this, but I want to put this out there first. Our claim is that God raised Jesus from the dead. When you put God into the mixture of it, that does change the background knowledge a bit. So that's why it's important, before I show arguments for the resurrection, I firmly believe it's important to show good philosophical arguments that God exists. Because believing that Jesus rose from the dead, it will be easier for someone to believe that Jesus rose from the dead, or to believe the claim that God raised Jesus from the dead, if they believe the prior claim that God actually exists. If you believe that God exists, it becomes much easier to believe that God revealed himself in history. So we have to include that, God's existence, in our background knowledge. And that's something that we can't put on the table. If we're going to discuss miracles, we also have to discuss the existence of God. And one other point I'll bring up is this. If you are against miracles because you say, well, they contradict our background knowledge of the world too much, I can never believe in them, then you already have an a priori or a fixed beforehand denial of miracles. You've set up your belief matrix, if you will. You've set up your way of assessing claims so that you could never believe in miracles. Because here's the thing. An event can't be a miracle unless it violates our background knowledge of the world in some way. If God is going to reveal himself, right? If he's going to use a miracle to reveal himself, he has to pick an event that stands out from the natural course of the world around us. So if I told people, look, God revealed himself, God spoke to me and he did a miracle. What's that? He took this water and made it solid. You'd say, well, that's not a miracle. Water turns solid all the time when it reaches a certain temperature. So a miracle, something that's a miracle, has to stand out from the background knowledge around it. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a miracle anymore. So it's kind of like how when you wear a life vest, a life jacket, why are life jackets orange? Well, life jackets are orange so that if you're lost at sea, it's easy to spot the orange life jacket against the blue water. If we lived in another universe where water was orange, the life jackets might be bright blue. So that's the thing with miracles. A miracle, by definition, has to stand out from the natural events in the world around us. And so that will make it something that we are initially suspicious of. But that's not a reason to reject miracles out of hand. Instead, it's a reason to approach them carefully and then to assess the quality of the evidence for that particular miracle.
How much more unbelievable is that? Our entire lives, we build on this background knowledge about how the world works. Does my moon lunch scenario become any more plausible if I amend it to say that God transported me to the moon for lunch and then sent me back home to Earth for dinner in the same day?
So that would be counter-abolitist replied, where I'm saying, well, we got to put God into the background knowledge, because if God exists and Jesus claims to be the fullest revelation of God, then it all starts to fit together that God would raise Jesus from the dead. So counter-apologists could say, fine, God took me to the moon and back. But then that would just lead me to ask further questions. Well, do you have evidence that you have a particular relationship or standing with God to justify that kind of claim? Is this a claim that you're willing to die for, like how the apostles were willing to be martyred for their belief that God raised Jesus from the dead? Are you functioning with a full picnic basket? You know, do you have a full dozen eggs up there in your brain that you're working with? Are you mentally deficient in some way? We would have to assess all of these claims and not just throw out these hypothetical examples. So someone makes an extraordinary claim, we shouldn't accept it immediately, but we also shouldn't just dismiss it out of hand. We should weigh the evidence for each case.
If I were to try and use a defense in a murder trial that my concealed carry handgun levitated out of my holster and fired on my hiking companion while in the middle of the woods, all to the sound of a demonic voice, would the jury accept or reject that claim? Would you want the jury to accept or reject that claim?
So when we're comparing background knowledge and other pieces of evidence to establish whether an event occurred, we also have to use the principle of the best explanation. Most of the arguments of the resurrection that I prefer would be arguments that use abductive reasoning or inference to the best explanation. So we have a variety of explanations, like if Jesus was raised from the dead, how do you explain all the evidence, the empty tomb, the post-crucifixion resurrection appearances of Jesus, the disciples' radical transformation into martyrs willing to die for their faith, Jesus' death by crucifixion? How do you explain all of that? And there's different explanations, but most of them, all the ones except for an actual resurrection, are deficient. They don't explain all these different elements. So in the case that counter-apologist gives us, we would see two people are hiking in the woods, and one of them is dead with a gunshot wound, and the other guy has a gun on him. The guy who has a gun on him says, well, my gun levitated out of my holster, and I heard a demonic voice, and it aimed at my friend, and it shot him. In this case, I would say the supernatural explanation is not the best. In this case, I would say the supernatural explanation is not the best explanation, because there are natural explanations that fit our background knowledge and more easily explain the events that are taking place. Either that the person who heard the demonic voice is actually mentally ill and shot his friend, which is something we do know people who hear voices and think that they see things, or that the person who shot their friend is a liar and they're lying about this to avoid being found guilty of murder. We know lots of people who will lie to avoid being found guilty of murder. But when it comes to the apostles and the resurrection of Jesus, those explanations don't work because we have groups of people, which would make it highly unlikely that they are all mentally ill when they've seen Jesus as a group together, and they're willing to die for these beliefs. They're living lives of virtue, willing to be martyred for their belief in the resurrection of Jesus, which is not something we would expect a liar or a person with the moral character of a liar to be willing to do. So whenever atheists put forward these other examples and they'll say, well, you don't believe the supernatural cause in this hypothetical example, so why do you believe the supernatural cause in the resurrection? I would say, well, there's different standards of evidence in your hypothetical. And I would say natural explanations suffice in those examples, but they don't suffice for the resurrection. Each case that is brought to us should be judged on its own merit.
Even if someone was recently convinced by an apologetic argument to be a mere theist, why should they regard the five pieces of testimonial evidence that we have to the resurrection of Jesus over other pieces of testimony we have for a wide array of miracle claims for contradictory religions like Hinduism, Mormonism, Islam, or even a host of others?
And this is something that atheists often do. They'll just throw out other religions. Well, why aren't you a Hindu? Why aren't you Mormon? Why aren't you Muslim? And I would say, like, during my conversion experience, I looked at the evidence for those religions, and I found them to be deficient in comparison to Christianity. When it comes to Christianity, we have evidence for a specific miracle at a specific point in history that was documented within a few years of the event happening. The creed describing the resurrection in St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians has been dated to within 5 years of the crucifixion. With Hinduism, we have claims of miracles that happened far, far off in the distant past. They're well beyond the reach of historical investigation. People have said that Hinduism is the oldest religion in the world. The claims for miraculous events happening in that religion are too far remote in history for us to be able to verify. When it comes to Islam, Muhammad never claimed to perform any miracles. The only miraculous evidence for Islam is the claim that the Quran is written in such an eloquent way it can't be rivaled by anyone else, which I would say is very poor evidence for divine causation. Somebody could make a piece of art that is very beautiful that can't be replicated. It doesn't mean that it's divinely inspired. But I also don't believe that is the case for the Quran, that when other non-Muslims examine it, they actually do find deficiencies in the Arabic grammar, mistakes in the scientific facts it purports to assert. Mormonism would be a different case. Mormonism actually is much more recent than any of those religions, so we have better access to the evidence around it. But that better access to the evidence actually provides more evidence that Joseph Smith was probably a charlatan, a person of low moral character who was fabricating evidence for Mormonism, or at the very least, he honestly, and I mean, that's one hypothesis. It could also be the case that he was honestly mistaken and whipped himself up into a religious frenzy, thinking that God had given a revelation to him when he actually didn't. But all of this, I would say, is far different from the evidence for Christianity.
Apologists like Mike Lacona like to argue that reality has a supernatural dimension and list off a few cases of miracles. But when they do this, they commit the fallacy of understated evidence. This is when you quote a general fact when it supports your conclusion, but the specific detailed facts actually count against your conclusion. The general fact that there are a lot of non-verifiable, implausible miracle claims would seem to support the idea that a supernatural realm exists. However, once we look more closely at the data, the specific details of miracle claims happen in support of contradictory religions, and this undermines the idea that the supernatural exists, or, at the very least, that miracles could serve as evidence for the truth of a specific religion.
Okay, so this is an interesting point that he kind of concedes to. I remember at once on Catholic Answers Live, I was speaking with an atheist and we were talking about miracles. And I said to him, what is more likely? Every single miracle claim, present and past, is false, or that at least one of them is true? I mean, there have been countless claims of miracles, both within Christianity and in non-Christian religions throughout history. And so I asked him, what is more likely? That all of them are false, or at least one of them is true? And it's interesting, he said, well, that all of them are false. And I said, well, why? Why would you think that's more likely? He said, because there's no God to cause miracles. And I said, okay, but now you're engaged in circular reasoning. You say that God doesn't exist because there's no evidence that he exists. But then when someone shows you an abundance of miraculous evidence for God, you say that's not actually evidence for God because God doesn't exist. It's engaging in circular reasoning. So what counter-apologist does in order to get around this saying, well, there's lots of different claims for miracles, is to try to make this an argument actually against Christianity, to say, well, wait a minute. If you have miracles in different religions, they all cancel each other out. So miracles can never be evidence for any particular religion. That's the point he's trying to make. But let me let him make it in his own words as he presents the following trilemma.
This leaves the Christian with a trilemma. One, some of the miracles occurred, but not others, but we are left with no objective way to determine which were true and which were false. Two, all of the miracles occurred, but then the miracles can't be used as evidence for the truth of the theological teachings of the miracle workers. Or three, none of the miracles actually occurred, and the testimony is based on fabrications and or legends.
Okay, so the trilemma says that either no miracle claims are verifiable, they're all made up, all the miracles that have been claimed to have happened actually have happened, which means that no miracle claim can ever prove the truth of a specific religion. So he's saying all the Hindu miracles, all the Muslim miracles, every miracle account has happened. These are the different options you're left with. Either there are no miracles, all miracle accounts are true, or some miracle accounts are true, but we have no way of telling which ones. We have no objective way to determine them. Well, let's compare that to any other historical event in history. Imagine if I said, well, either no assassinations have ever happened, all assassinations have happened, or some assassinations in history have happened, but we have no way of knowing if an event was an assassination of a leader or whether he actually died of natural causes. You know, whenever you take, I remember reading an old test-taking book a long time ago when I was studying for the SATs when I was in high school, and this test-taking book said, be wary of answers to questions that have all or none in them. They're more likely to be false. And I would say that here with history, all or none usually aren't the best terms to throw in there. I think some miracles are legitimate and others are not. Even the Catholic Church approaches miracles in this way. The Catholic Church won't say that every single claim of a miracle that a saint has done in history has happened. You'll read accounts in Christian authors throughout history and in the Church Fathers of different saints being purported to have performed miracles, but some of them are clearly legendary accounts that grew centuries in the telling. They're not reliable pieces of evidence, and so we'd say, well, if you want to believe that, you can, but you can also hold that there really is no good evidence for this particular saint performing this particular miracle. There's not enough evidence for that. You know, the church, even when determining if a saint is to be canonized, weighs the evidence to see if miracles have actually occurred during the invocation of that saint, such as whether someone praying over someone and asking for that saint's intercession and they're healed. The church will investigate to say, well, is this a healing that could have happened naturally, or is it something beyond what medical knowledge can tell us is possible for the body to be able to heal itself? So I would just reject counter-apologist assertion that there is no objective way for us to determine if a miracle has happened. We can just apply the same standards that we use for other historical events. Is the source of the event, is that something that is close in proximity to the event being described, both geographically and temporally? If it's written centuries later on another continent, it's not going to be really good evidence for that miracle. If it's written within a few decades or even a few years of the event, and it's not just a sole single individual writing about it, but if you have multiple individuals that can attest to this, then you start having a lot more evidence for that particular miracle. But what about the claim that this could apply to other religions? What about if you can use this same method and show that Christian miracles happen, but you have miracles in other religions? Does that mean you can't ever use miracles to prove that a particular religion is true? I would reject that reasoning. First, if you show that a supernatural event occurs, it could be the case that God is the cause of some of these events, such as the miracles in Christianity, but that supernatural events in other religions or other belief systems could be the work of other supernatural entities. I would say, for example, it would be the work of the devil and his demons to lead people astray. That if you use historical evidence to show there are supernatural events that occur, we could just say they have a supernatural cause. And then we might bring our theology into play to say, all right, so it could be the case in these non-Christian religions that God has allowed a supernatural event to occur, such as through demonic activity, or that God has caused a supernatural event to occur for some kind of reason related to his divine providence. Maybe he wants to help the people of this time and place to be more open to the supernatural in general so that they're more receptive to the preaching of the gospel. I don't know. God's ways, as high as the heavens are above the earth, God's ways are above our ways, as the prophet Isaiah says. Speaking of providence, keep that word in mind as we go through how counter-apologist talks about different kinds of miracles.
My next point is to show how the skeptic position that none of the miracles actually occurred is the most likely. This is due to the nature and types of miracle claims. Miracles can come in two types, each with two subsets for a total of four categories. The first is what I call minor improbable miracles. This is where an event happens that seems unlikely but occurs in a religious context but can have a naturalistic explanation, like praying to find your keys and opening your eyes and then immediately seeing them.
All right, right off the bat, we have a problem here because counter-apologist hasn't defined what a miracle is. If he had defined a miracle, he would show that his distinction between minor improbable and major improbable miracles is not a good one. He seems to be defining a miracle as God causing something to happen in the world. So God caused you to find your keys, but you know, that happens every day for people. That could be something that could have a natural explanation as well. So a miracle, by definition, is not just God causing something to happen. God causes the whole world to happen. God sustains the whole world in existence. Rather, a miracle, and different people will define miracles in different ways, but I would say a miracle occurs when God suspends the laws of nature to cause an event to happen that has no natural explanation. A miracle is something, by definition, that has no natural explanation. It is caused because God doesn't contradict the laws of nature. It's not like the laws of nature are something that stand over and above God, but that God suspends the operation of the laws of nature temporarily to allow Jesus to walk on water, to cause food to appear from nothing, to multiply bread and fish, or to reverse the effects of death and to be raised from the dead. A miracle has to suspend the laws of nature, and it can't have a natural explanation for it. So what counter-apologist, when he says a minor improbable miracle, he's talking about providence, just when God arranges natural explanations in the world for a particular end, like if you pray to look for your keys, and then they're there. That could just be luck. That could be luck, or it could be divine providence, but it's not a miracle.
The alternative is a major improbable miracle. This is an event with something that seems very unlikely occurs in a religious context, but nevertheless, the event can still have a naturalistic explanation.
So yeah, this is, once again, divine providence. Like if somebody prayed in front of an abortion facility, "Lord, close this facility today," and then the facility has a gas leak spontaneously and the abortion facility is closed, counter-apologists would probably call that a major improbable miracle. I would call that divine providence. But also, you could attribute it to chance in some cases through something called the law of large numbers, that when you have 7 billion people in the world, highly, highly improbable things are going to happen quite often. But once again, if it has a natural explanation, then it's not a miracle.
In both of these cases, the fact that a miracle occurred is completely unverifiable. It is possible for it to have happened.
What he means by miracle, of course, is divine action. It's possible God caused all of this to happen, but since we're dealing with natural explanations, we can never prove God caused these natural things to happen. And he's right, but this is providence, it's not miracles.
But neither side can prove it, and neither the skeptic or the theist can assume that their side is true without begging the question. This does not mean that either side is unjustified or irrational in holding their respective opinions on the matter, but that is a complex rabbit trail that I will explore in the longer video. The next two kinds of miracle are as follows. Non-verifiable, physically impossible miracles. These are the supposed events where something physically impossible happens, but it is claimed in a non-verifiable context or time, or it is the type of miracle itself that is inherently unfalsifiable by its nature. The resurrection of someone in the far past would be a good case.
Notice here when he's talking about non-verifiable and unfalsifiable, it seems like counter-apologists and a lot of atheists like him want to subject the proof of miracles to the scientific method. What they'll say is, well, I'll believe in a miracle if you can prove it scientifically. But that is like saying, I'll believe there are plastic cups buried on the beach if you can find them with a metal detector. You're using the wrong tool. A miracle, by definition, is an unusual event that does not happen with regularity. It is a temporary suspension of the laws of nature for God to accomplish some kind of event in history. Science, by definition, is the application of natural laws to events that happen with regularity. So scientific explanations use natural laws to describe things that happen with some kind of regularity in the natural world. So to say that, oh, well, these kinds of physically impossible miracles like a resurrection, they're unfalsifiable and they're non-verifiable. Well, that's the same thing as saying that, well, we can't really believe that happened. That's non-verifiable and it's unfalsifiable. There's no scientific experiment you can do in the Alps to show, oh yeah, there were elephants here over 2,000 years ago. Instead, you just have to examine the written accounts of this event and see, were they written with some proximity to the event? Were they written by reliable witnesses? Do we have good evidence for this particular event happening? And that would be the case for miracles, especially these quote-unquote non-verifiable, physically impossible miracles. That miracles are something that don't happen with regularity. It seems like for counter-apologists, he wants them to happen with regularity, and that's the only way he's going to believe that it's actually a miracle, as we'll see with the fourth kind of miracle, the only one he's willing to give a fair shake at.
It should be noted that some of these miracles would be verifiable in a specific time frame, but would lapse shortly after the conclusion. The final category are verifiable, physically impossible miracles. These are the kinds of events that we can say we definitely do not have any instances of, because if we did, they'd be demonstrated. This is the sort of miracle where we would have strong empirical evidence of, say, an amputee having a limb regrown, or better yet, a continual miracle of rocks floating out spelling Jesus Christ is the Son of God who died for your sins in some place that would be considered holy. Or, the best example, only believers in the one true religion being able to perform a specific physically impossible miracle. In fact, God supposedly performed these kinds of verifiable miracles in the Bible, at least in the time-limited sense, including by apostles after Jesus' death, with no explanation as to why they seem to have stopped. Since three of the four kinds of miracles are the sort that can't be verified one way or the other, and we lack examples where we can empirically verify the physically impossible miracle occurred, we have to come up with something called methodological naturalism. This is the idea that in science, history, and other areas of study, as part of our methodology, we presume that metaphysical naturalism is true.
So what that means is that for scientific experiments, that just means that for scientific experiments, you can't include God or other supernatural entities as part of your explanation in scientific experiments. There's no way you could actually know you've excluded them from the experiment. You can't say, hey, God, stay out of this experiment for a minute. I need to have a variable versus the control. You wouldn't be able to do that. You wouldn't be able to test it. Science works by using methodological naturalism. It just for the method, when we're investigating whether phenomena happened, scientists are not able to incorporate God or other supernatural entities into the explanation. But that's not the same thing as metaphysical naturalism or the claim that only the natural world exists and God does not exist. So the main problem here that counter-apologist is running up against is he's basically saying we can't believe in miracles because we need to use science to determine what's true or to quote-unquote verify them, but science uses methodological naturalism. So you're using a tool, you're saying this is the tool I need to prove a miracle has happened, but it's a tool that is designed to never come up with a divine explanation or a supernatural explanation. It's part of the very definition of the tool. What makes it science and not theology or even philosophy is that naturalistic element. Science doesn't say there is no God or there is no supernatural. It's just agnostic or open on the question. It doesn't make a judgment.
Apologists like Mike Lacona argue against methodological naturalism, saying that if an empirically verifiable, physically impossible miracle occurred in front of a scientist's face, they'd be bound by the principle not to say anything about it. This, however, is a caricature, since skeptics, scientists, and historians don't hold to methodological naturalism as a kind of a priori, first principle that shall never be violated. It is held posteriori, after consideration of the evidence. If we gain instances of an empirically verifiable, physically impossible miracle occurring, you can bet we would drop methodological naturalism. In fact, this is the kind of thing atheists and skeptics have asked believers for years in order to convince us. To illustrate this, consider the thought experiment. Imagine our world as it is now, except at every Mass in every Catholic Church, when the priest goes to do the communion, he pours water into a clear glass, and as he says a prayer, the water turns into wine before the entire congregation. Imagine that this could be studied under controlled conditions. Scientists could verify the water pre-prayer, inspect the priests, control their garments, inspect the wine afterwards. The wine could even be the same type and molecular composition every time, regardless of the type of water put into the cup ahead of time. Far from being mundane, this would be the highlight of every service, especially since no other religions could replicate this kind of empirically verifiable miracle. One wonders if there would even be other religions if this world was real. In such a world, with this kind of background knowledge informing our beliefs, we would be able to interpret historical Christian miracle claims in a way not available to miracle claims made by competing, contradictory religions. We would have a solid basis for concluding that the Christian miracle claims were true and reason to doubt the others as false. We wouldn't even have other denominations of Christianity if only Catholic priests could do the miracle.
I only made it through 2/3 of Counter-Apologist's short video. Whenever I'm trying to do rebuttal videos, it's always hard. My most recent rebuttal video on the Council of Trent YouTube channel is over 3 hours long, and I was replying to originally something that was just a little over an hour, because it takes a lot longer to rebut something than it does just to put out different claims. But here are just some of my concluding thoughts on this style of argument from counter-apologist and other atheists like him. First, I don't understand this argument as saying, well, I don't believe in the resurrection because I would believe in a miracle if you gave me all of this kind of amazing evidence that's regular, it's something that happens over and over again. That is something that I would believe in. But that's like saying, I don't believe that Fred shot Bob because I would believe Fred shot Bob if you had 100 witnesses that were there and saw it happen. Well, I would say, well, no, you're not asked to determine whether Fred shot Bob based on the evidence you wish you had. You should say, would you believe it based on the evidence that you do have, which is we have one eyewitness that some people doubt, but other people find to be quite trustworthy. We have other forensic evidence that puts Fred at the scene of the crime. We have motives that are involved. So I don't understand with the resurrection saying, I don't believe in it because I wish we had this kind of evidence. Or I don't believe in miracles because I want this kind of evidence for miracles. Well, you have to work with the evidence you do have, and you have to have a standard to say, look, what, and this is a question I ask atheists that you should ask them, what is the bare minimum amount of evidence that would be required to believe in any particular event? And what's interesting here, this goes back to our background knowledge, if you believe in God or not. If you're an atheist who will say that there's a strict difference between events with a natural cause and a supernatural cause, and you're already thinking God doesn't exist or you lack belief in God, and so you bracket these supernatural events and they require a ton more evidence, because if you had this kind of hyper-skepticism, you would actually end up doubting a lot of extraordinary claims throughout history. I mean, imagine somebody saying over 100 years ago, in 1903, hey, did you hear about those Wright brothers in Kitty Hawk, North Carolina? People from the past always just sound like that to me. They actually flew one of them aeroplanes. And you say, well, what are you talking about? Lord Kelvin and other scientists like him said in 1895 and in the early 1900s that the airplane will never fly. You know, there are scientists who are convinced that airplanes could never fly, and an airplane had never flown before 1903. So that's an extraordinary event, and yet that's something a lot of people believe just by reading a newspaper account about it, but, you know, by the testimony of some witnesses. So this another example I like to use in this would be, imagine, and this is something that David Hume tried to get around unsuccessfully, I would say, would be someone from England visiting Tahiti and talking about how people can walk across lakes in England during the winter. They become solid. Now, if you have never seen ice before in your life, that would be an extraordinary claim. And under the atheist view, you wouldn't be justified in believing it. So I'd be concerned about this hyper-skepticism of saying we need this fantastic evidence to believe extraordinary claims, when if you applied that to all different kinds of extraordinary claims, you would end up rejecting many extraordinary truths that are out there. But in any case, I hope that was just kind of a helpful introduction to replying to philosophical arguments against the resurrection. You're finding more of those now from atheists that it used to be when atheists would argue against the resurrection, they would just say, well, look, there's contradictions in the Bible accounts. They're contradictory, so I don't believe in the resurrection. But apologists have done a good job in showing that many ancient historical documents have supposed contradictions or details that are described differently, but that doesn't negate the truth of the historical event they describe. So you have people like Mike Lacona, who has a great book called The Resurrection of Jesus, A New Historiographical Approach. Andrew Lokay has a new book out on the resurrection. Resources I would recommend. If you want other arguments on the resurrection, check out my book, Counterfeit Christ, as well. But more and more, I am seeing atheists making primarily philosophical arguments against the resurrection, saying even if it did happen, we wouldn't be able to be justified in believing this miracle happened. So I hope this is a good introduction in countering this kind of counter-apologetic. So thank you guys so much, and it's great to be back here on the podcast, and I hope that you all have a very blessed day.
If you liked today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.